Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of GTI Insights, the Global Taiwan Institute's policy podcast. My name is Marshall Reed, and I'm a program manager here with GTI.
And I'm Daniela Martinez, an intern at GTI.
And today we're so thrilled to be joined by Dr. Stephen Nagy, a senior associate professor at the Department of Politics and International Studies at International Christian University in Tokyo. In addition, he serves as a fellow at the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, a visiting fellow with the Japan Institute for International Affairs, a senior fellow at the McDonald Laurier Institute, and a senior fellow at the East Asia Security Center. He's written and spoken extensively on matters related to Indo-Pacific diplomacy and political affairs, and his research has been published in a wide variety of academic journals and media outlets. Dr. Nagy, thanks so much for sitting down with us today.
It's a real great opportunity to come and share some ideas with you. Thanks, Marshall.
Well, I think this is really a great time to discuss Canada's approach to both the Indo-Pacific more broadly and the Taiwan Strait more specifically. Just last year, Ottawa published its really long-awaited Indo-Pacific strategy, which outlined a really wide range of new initiatives and priorities for the Indo-Pacific region. While it certainly remains to be seen, I think, exactly how this new strategy will shape Canadian foreign policy going forward, I think it's clear that it represents a fairly substantial evolution in Ottawa's overall perspective towards the region. With that in mind, we're very excited to hear your thoughts on Canada's priorities for the region, Ottawa's ties with Taiwan, and Ottawa's hopes for the future. So just to start, we'd like for you to set the stage a bit. You know, for listeners in the United States and Taiwan who might not necessarily follow Canada's foreign policy approach, you know, very closely, how does Ottawa traditionally approach the Indo-Pacific, and how have its priorities for the region evolved over time?
Well, you know, I'm not a diplomat or a representative of the government, so I have more, I guess, a critical view of how Canada's engaged in the Asia-Pacific or Asia or Indo-Pacific. You know, up to now, there was real debate of whether it was wise to use the Indo-Pacific framing for Canada's engagement in the Asia-Pacific. I think there was some scholars and policy advisors that felt that pivoting to the Indo-Pacific concept was something that was geopolitical and perhaps could raise tension with China. And I think that this view was really based on the view that Canada's prosperity and Canada's engagement within the region should be with the largest economy in the region, and that was China. But as we know, the geopolitical situation, I think domestic trends in China and its external behavior has alarmed not only Canada, but many like-minded countries. And I think that we've seen a shift where Canada's moved away from a purely mercantilistic kind of middle power normative approach to the region, where they're advocating human security and human rights and democracy promotion and development and trade, to one that really recognizes the geopolitical realities within the region. We have a disruptive China that is trying to dominate the South China Sea. It's interested in a forced reunification with Taiwan, which will be fundamentally disruptive to supply chains. We have challenges in the East China Sea with regards to Japan. We, of course, have North Korea as well with its weapons proliferation. And most recently, of course, is the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. So the region doesn't look good. The common refrain here in not only in the Indo-Pacific where I live in Tokyo, but in Ottawa, is this real realization that there's a possibility of something fundamentally disrupting the Indo-Pacific region, and Canada needs to be at the table rather than on the menu in terms of providing public goods to the region, in terms of being a rule setter to the region, and providing some security goods to stabilize and ensure that the region continues to develop peacefully and stably.
Late last year, Canada released its long-awaited Indo-Pacific strategy, in which it emphasized the importance of the region for the future of Canadian foreign policy. From your perspective, what were some of the highlights of this strategy? And will the document have a meaningful impact on Canada's foreign policy approach to the region?
So thanks so much, Daniela. So the document is a political document. I think that it represents Canadian domestic politics and political interest, with its focus on the environment, its focus on progressive cultural issues and how that's linked to diplomacy and a so-called feminist foreign policy agenda. It's focused on Indigenous reconciliation as well, not only in Canada, but using the Canadian Indo-Pacific strategy to foster Indigenous reconciliation in countries and political entities in and around the Indo-Pacific region. These are front and center in the policy, quite frankly. We see this with the innovative diplomacy to try and work with Taiwan, New Zealand, and Australia and the Pacific Islands in terms of Indigenous reconciliation and environmental policy. We see specific initiatives to try and bolster Indigenous economies. And I think that this is something that is not only innovative, but again, it links our domestic political priorities of the present government in Ottawa to how they view the region. There's a strong trade pillar. The trade pillar is to expand FTAs with ASEAN as well as India, where the former is going to be a challenge because of countries like Myanmar and the heterogeneity of ASEAN. But since the accusations about the Indian government's involvement in the killing in Canada of a Canadian citizen, it looks like the FTA with India is also at least on the deathbed, or perhaps it's already dead. So we have a trade pillar that is challenged. But I think significantly, the policy calls out China as a disruptive power and that Canada needs to be in the region trying to, again, support peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait and in the East China Sea and the South China Sea, and push back against authoritarian expansionism with like-minded countries and political entities, whether it's Japan, South Korea, the United States, Taiwan, Australia. I think these are really important aspects of our Canadian Indo-Pacific strategy. And most importantly, it has some resources behind it, about 2.3 billion Canadian dollars in the first installment of what the Canadian government calls down payment for a 10-year strategy. This is a once-in-a-generation shift in terms of Canadian thinking about the region and trying to craft a grand strategy of how to engage in the Indo-Pacific region. And where it goes from here will depend on implementation, government support, and of course, what happens within the region.
I'm so glad you mentioned Canada and Taiwan's collaboration on Indigenous issues. I think that it's a really fascinating example of the subnational cooperation that Taiwan has really excelled at in recent years. Could you elaborate a little bit more on these programs? What other ways do you think Taiwan and Canada can work together on a sub-state basis?
Well, Ottawa hasn't moved away from Ottawa's one China policy. And what that means is that Ottawa continues to recognize Beijing as, you know, the capital of a unified China, and Taiwan being part of China in a Canadian defined way. But at the same time, that Canada has made the choice that they see Taiwan as an important political entity within the Indo-Pacific region. It has a vibrant democracy, a vibrant civil society. It enjoys freedom of press and rule of law. And these are shared values that Canada has with Taiwan. And it wants to ensure that Taiwan remains a vibrant, democratic, free, and open society. And in order to do that, they're trying to find different platforms, pillars to engage with Taiwan within Canada's own One China policy. And I think they look at Indigenous reconciliation and Indigenous economic revitalization or vitalization as really non-state levels of engaging with Taiwan that produce sustainable results that demonstrate the shared interests and shared ability to cooperate between Ottawa and Taipei. And I think, again, it wants to deliver something that addresses important issues to both Canada and Taiwan. And I think they both are really wedded to Indigenous reconciliation, Indigenous recognition, and try to demonstrate that their societies are plural societies where many different cultures and peoples prosper. And I think contributing to Indigenous vitalization through economic aid is a really good example of that, where Taipei and Ottawa are working together.
What's really fascinating and encouraging to hear all the ways that Canada and Taiwan have found to collaborate at a, you know, subnational or people-to-people level. But I do want to take a step back a bit and look at the broader picture here. You know, a common refrain we've heard here at GTI, particularly from states in the West, is that Taiwan is just a long way away. You know, for years it's been seen, particularly by states in North America and Western Europe, as, you know, something of a peripheral issue. It's far from the doorstep of many of these states. And so I think a big concern for Taiwan and those that are interested in Taiwan is convincing people that Taiwan is an important issue that does have real ramifications for these states. So I'd be curious to hear from your perspective, you know, why is Taiwan important to Canada? Why does Canada and why should Canadians care about Taiwan?
So I think Taiwan's political situation is difficult for every country on the planet. But I think most countries that share the same values as Taiwan want to engage with Taiwan. They want to continue to support its democratic system, its free and open society, its freedom of press, and again, this vibrant civil society. And it does this primarily through citizen-to-citizen interactions, through business-to-business interactions, through, I guess, this Indigenous cooperation, as I mentioned, education exchanges. And that has been the primary way. But really, beginning, I think, in 2015, 16, 17, Taiwan's role in the sea lines of communication, its roles in semiconductor supply chains and technology supply chains, its roles as a democratic bastion within the Indo-Pacific region, and importantly, its role in combating disinformation and developing really important approaches to disinformation by authoritarian China has been recognized as really critical comparative advantages that Taiwan has that Canada and other like-minded countries have to engage with. So just last month, I was in Taipei, and we had some really super discussions about how Taiwan was managing disinformation from the mainland. And again, countries like Canada have similar problems. We have a large ethnic Chinese diaspora, and they're susceptible to disinformation that's being deployed by the mainland. And you know, we have to work with places like Taiwan that have deep experience in managing disinformation and try to create more literacy about what's happening within the region. And this has become, I think, one of the core areas where Canada wants to work with Taiwan. But I also mentioned supply chains. Taiwan's place in semiconductor supply chains and technology is another area that Canada is very interested in cooperating with and finding ways to ensure that Taiwan's position within technology supply chains remains secure and stable, and that it can continue to provide those critical semiconductors to countries like Canada. I also mentioned security. There's real realization that Canada's economic security is linked to Taiwan's future. And if we see a forced reunification with Taiwan through the military, this fundamentally disrupts supply chains, fundamentally disrupt the $5.5 trillion US dollars of trades that is linked with the South China Sea and the Taiwan Straits. So Canada's trying to find ways to contribute to peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait, to enhance Taiwan's deterrence, to enhance its vibrant democracy. And I think that these, again, are some core areas that Canada is trying to work with Taiwan in, again, contributing to the Indo-Pacific's region's broader stability and recognizing that Taiwan is a real critical part of that broader stability puzzle.
Well, I want to delve a little bit deeper into that support for Taiwan and Canada. Something we've been pleased to see in the last couple of years in the U.S. is that there really has been more support for Taiwan than in the past. It's really emerged as one of the few, you know, truly bipartisan issues. I'm interested to hear from your perspective, is there that sort of, you know, unanimous support for Taiwan in Canada? You know, is there a political consensus about the necessity of supporting Taiwan? And maybe even more importantly, is support for Taiwan limited to the political sphere, to the halls of power, or is it really more of a popular thing that's in the public awareness?
So I think that it's growing. There's growing awareness of the importance of Taiwan in terms of the broader Indo-Pacific stability and, again, supply chains and trade in and around and through the South China Sea, East China Sea, and Taiwan Straits. So that is really, really important. But I don't think we've been able to articulate, or politicians haven't been able to articulate, how what happens to Taiwan matters to Canadians. Let me give you some examples of how I would articulate it. You know, the supply chains that are associated with semiconductors, well, those semiconductors go into cars that are made in Canada. And guess what? You know, those car manufacturers, well, they hire hundreds of thousands of Canadians. So if we see a disruption across the Taiwan Strait in terms of semiconductors, it will have a direct impact on employment in Canada. And I think these are the kinds of arguments that politicians need to make to really convey to the public that, you know, what happens to Taiwan matters. I also think that, you know, the idea of peaceful reunification is something that I think Canadians would probably support if it was a choice of both mainland and Taiwan. But forced reunification, certainly not, because it would spiral into a regional conflict that would have serious human implications, but of course, economic implications that would again spill over to Canada. So these kinds of arguments are not being made with the kind of clarity that I think need to be made by politicians to get support of the public. That being said, there has been a shift in the terms of the Liberals and the Conservatives in terms of how they are putting Taiwan front and center in their policy. The Liberals try to take, I think, a more nuanced approach in some ways by, you know, burying Taiwan and the issues of Taiwan within the broader Indo-Pacific strategy, but still trying to contribute to its peace and stability. Conservatives want to call out China, I think, much more explicitly in terms of its coercion against Taiwan, and the Conservatives would like to have a much more explicit support for Taiwan, but within a one China policy. the public is mixed. Cities and provinces like Vancouver and British Columbia are very, very, very Asia-oriented. They have huge numbers of ethnic Chinese diaspora there. And there's a very heterogeneous ethnic Chinese community that has a plurality of views. Some are very pro-Taiwan, some are pro-Hong Kong, some are pro-mainland. And this complex formula shapes the local politics and how they think about Taiwan. And then that percolates back up to politics in Ottawa. So I would really hesitate to say there's one view. I think that there's a plurality of views, but they're all moving really towards the recognition that, again, what happens to Taiwan matters, and that Canada needs to craft a nuanced, comprehensive, and balanced approach to preserving peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait, while at the same time doing this within a Canadian-defined One China policy.
I think it's great that you mentioned the role of other countries in this conversation. In the past, you've written extensively about the need to increase multilateral engagement between like-minded countries in the Indo-Pacific, particularly when it comes to the Taiwan Strait. What sorts of other opportunities do you currently see for those sorts of engagements? And how can other regional capitals get involved?
Okay, so here I think that we can look at areas of cooperation in terms of trade, in terms of disinformation, in terms of deterrence, and perhaps in terms of underwater cables and perhaps cybersecurity. So let's think of trade. I think right now, both Taiwan and the mainland have both applied for an accession to the Comprehensive Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's pretty clear that the mainland doesn't meet the minimum requirements to join the TPP, but Taiwan does. And here, I think that Canada, working with Japan and other members of the current TPP, should strongly advocate for Taiwan's accession to the TPP, but they should do it using, I think, the BRI playbook. When China goes out and talks to New South Wales or Victoria and Australia, they're not talking to Canberra before they engage and sign BRI agreements with these Australian states or Australian cities. And I think we should use that logic in terms of the TPP accession, saying, listen, this is what you're doing. You're not consulting the central governments and countries to join your BRI. We're going to use the same process to include Taiwan in the Comprehensive Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think this is an innovative way to, again, weave Taiwan into multilateral agreements such as the Comprehensive Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership. It would strengthen its place in the global economy and in these leading trade agreements. And again, I think it means that what happens to Taiwan matters to all the current TPP members. So economic front, that's a great way to do it. I mentioned deterrence. I think that, again, we need to help Taiwan deal with some of the challenges associated with its relationship with the mainland. And one of the core areas is, I think, multilateral cross-strait transits, where Canada works perhaps with Japan or works with the United States or Germany or other countries and engages in the cross-strait transits at the midline between the mainland and Taiwan to demonstrate that this is international waters. I think, frankly, it's too dangerous for just Canada to do it by itself, but in multilateral framings, again, this sends home the message that these countries are demonstrating that this is international waters. It does provide some deterrence capabilities to Taiwan as well. I think there's other areas of cooperation that can go on as well, where perhaps Taiwanese military does do some joint training with Canada or with Australia. I think even within the RIMPAC exercise, it would be interesting to see a Taiwan participate either as an observer or a direct participant. I think there's also opportunities for Taiwan to plug into the quadrilateral security dialogue in terms of search and rescue operations and training, in terms of humanitarian disaster assistance training. These are all areas, again, to start to create people-to-people, military-to-military ties, but are within a form of cooperation that is relatively within the confines of providing public goods rather than an offensive capability. I mentioned disinformation. I think it's a really, really important area, and this is something that Taiwan can offer to Japan or Canada and other countries in terms of how they're managing disinformation. I could foresee Taiwan chairing and leading a non-state level form of disinformation training and research to help these countries manage disinformation that is emerging out of countries like China as well. So these are some particular areas that I think are ripe for cooperation, and they would really bring benefits to not only Taiwan, but the partners that Taiwan would engage with in the areas of economy, deterrence, and disinformation.
It's been great to see Taiwan's rising prominence really around the world, you know, in capitals in Japan and South Korea and Europe and Canada. you've been seeing so much more awareness of Taiwan more broadly, and more specifically, the importance of Taiwan to contributing to the international system, to its role in supply chains and trade flows. So I think there really is cause for optimism in a lot of ways. But, you know, on the other side of the coin, as we talked about at the beginning of this conversation, this is a difficult time for the international system, to say the least. You know, there's a huge amount of geopolitical turmoil. There are wars in Ukraine and in the Middle East. And I think just in general, instability is kind of the rule of the day at the moment. So I'd be curious to hear from your perspective in Japan, and given your expertise on Indo-Pacific geopolitics and geopolitics more broadly, are you optimistic about Taiwan's prospects going forward? And how can Taiwan and, you know, like-minded states and Canada and the United States contribute to a more stable and favorable outcome for Taiwan looking forward?
Well, that's a tough question. I think that we've moved into a period of extreme instability within the international system, where authoritarian states are really looking for a window of opportunity to destabilize a rules-based international order so that they prioritize more Westphalian or sovereignty-first views about state. Although they're advocating for the democratization of the international order, where the developing countries and emerging countries have a more say in the international system, I think that this is a kind of faux or false democratization. And countries like China and Russia really want to dilute the influence of the West, dilute the influence of the United States, and ensure that a kind of might is right, Machiavellian approach to international relations is the modus operandi and how international affairs works. We have a deep-seated interest in resisting that. Smaller countries and small political entities that don't have a lot of power have a deep-seated interest in an international order based on rule of law, where rule of law curbs the behavior of big states and small states and middle states. And we are in a period where we're really competing for which order is going to be the order of the future. So in a sense, I'm pessimistic in that the competition is just starting, and that we're going to have to work together very cohesively to try and resist these authoritarian objectives. Where I'm optimistic, and I think this is important on the Taiwan front, I think that there is real realization following the invasion of Ukraine by Russia that something similar across the Taiwan Strait really would not benefit China. It would not make China stronger. It would not make China more respected. It would have the completely opposite effect. And that if Xi Jinping really wants to achieve its sanitary goals of 2049, that forced reunification with Taiwan is not on the table. So that's an optimistic view about where things are going. Again, Canada's engagement in the region is optimistic. I think it's great that we've pivoted to the region through the Indo-Pacific strategy, and we're investing in important relationships like Taiwan and Japan and South Korea. At the same time, I think that the Canadian Indo-Pacific strategy has really spread the peanut butter too thin. It's quite ambitious. It's investing all over rather than building, I think, really focused partnerships that can bring meaningful, sustainable diplomatic achievements to the region. And then based on that, kind of build momentum for expanding Canada's presence within the region. So thinking about where Canada should go, again, I think it should strengthen its partnerships with places like Taiwan, Japan, South Korea, Singapore, and Vietnam, and use those achievements to, again, build stronger partnerships within the broader region. Can it do that? This is a real big question. Canada's diplomacy at this particular stake is challenged because of domestic politics, some decisions with regards to India, China. And quite frankly, in 2 years or a year and a half, we may have a different party in the White House that will make Canada's engagement within the Indo-Pacific region more complex. And I think these are questions that not only Ottawa is facing, but Taipei, Tokyo, Seoul, Singapore, and many other capitals are wondering how they're going to manage an increasingly complicated and unpredictable United States.
Well, Dr. Nagy, I think that's a great place to kind of wrap things up. But I do want to note something that I've really enjoyed about this conversation is that we haven't exclusively been talking about Taiwan-Canada bilateral ties. You know, that's been an important part of it, of course. But I appreciate that you've brought the conversation out a little bit and expanded it to include other countries in the region. I'd love to hear from you why that's so important. You know, why is it important to not just talk bilaterally, but to talk minilaterally or multilaterally about Taiwan? What does that contribute to the conversation, and what does that contribute to Taiwan?
Sure. And, you know, just on that last point, Marshall, we've seen the internationalization of the Taiwan issue really beginning back in 2021. And now we see Taiwan in international statements from the G7, from NATO, bilateral statements. And this is really, really important. We can internationalize the Taiwan issue so that many countries see the value and the importance of peace and stability across the Taiwan Straits. And I hope that that is the direction we continue to go to ensure that Taiwan remains Taiwan, but the region remains, again, peaceful and stable and prosperous.
Well, I think that's a really great place to bring this conversation to a close. I think it's been a really interesting discussion, both because the bilateral relationship between Canada and Taiwan is fascinating, but also because I think it seems like Canada and its approach to Taiwan is really indicative of broader trends in the international system toward Taiwan. You know, it seems like there's so much more interest in Taiwan and realization of the importance of Taiwan to so many parts of the international system. And Canada seems to be recognizing that and behaving accordingly. So I think you've given us a lot of cause for optimism, but obviously there's a lot of challenges to the international system, and Taiwan is going to continue to face challenges going forward. But it does seem like there's a path forward. And I think we all need to work together on this. Canada, with other like-minded partners, work with Taiwan to really safeguard it and make sure that it continues to contribute to the international community in the way it does now. But Dr. Nagy, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Cheers. Thanks so much.
And thank you to all our listeners for joining us for another great episode of GTI Insights. Many thanks also to the great staff and interns at GTI for all of their help with every step of producing this podcast. If you're interested in learning more about GTI, be sure to check out our website at globaltaiwan.org, where you can find information about our Global Taiwan Brief, other publications, our other public seminars. You can also listen to more episodes of GTI Insights on Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Until next time, this has been GTI Insights.